on this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Being humble is realizing that you're not that damn important in the grand scheme of time and space. Investigate all these forms of discomfort that we've lost over time from our lives that used to keep us relatively healthy. Holy hell, this is like the most cliche thing ever, right? Like this gangly Western rider has come to see the guru, appreciating that we live in an unbelievably amazing world right now. But if we always do the next easy thing, that's going to get us in trouble too.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
All right, folks, clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits. And inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
Well, folks, it's probably no secret that I kind of like to do hard shit sometimes, like I was doing this morning, you know, sweating my butt off in a sauna and jumping in my little cold pool afterwards. And of course, I exercise. I do things like intermittent fasting. I've talked about this whole concept of hormesis on the podcast and interviewed folks like, you know, Scott Carney about his book, What Doesn't Kill You, or interviewed guys like, you know, Wim Hof about their hypoxia, hyperoxia, breath work and cold thermogenesis protocols. And it seems like these days, a lot of us are kind of wandering around hunting down ways to almost like embrace discomfort to a certain extent. And probably there's no better modern contemporary example of that in a very immersive journalistic type of sense as my guest who's here with me right now, Michael Easter. He wrote a book and it came out a little while ago. I actually wanted to interview him like close to when the book came out because I read it and I enjoyed it. And we've just like had a hell of a time hooking up. But, you know, perhaps either procrastination or having to wait to do a podcast is also a form of hormesis. So we finally made it happen. If you don't know who Michael is, well, he writes books. He's a journalist, obviously, but he's kind of all over the map. You may have seen him on the Joe Rogan Experience talking about his embracing of discomfort. He's also a professor when he's not on the ground reporting in the journalism department at University of Nevada in Las Vegas, where he also lives, kind of out on the edge of the desert out there, or so I've heard. And he also writes in a lot of different magazines like Men's Health and Men's Journal and Cosmopolitan and Vice and Esquire and Scientific American and Women's Health and a whole lot of others. He gets a lot of respect for what he does. That book, The Comfort Crisis, was actually a bestseller. And man, oh man, it's crazy. Michael, you went all over the place. You met with monks in ancient monasteries in Bhutan. You went to like Bolivia to look into what the lost tribes in the jungles of Bolivia were doing. You hung out with U.S. Special Forces soldiers. You hung out with gene scientists in Iceland and CEOs in Fortune 500 boardrooms. And you just basically kind of pulled out all the stops. And perhaps one of the most interesting parts of the book for me, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of these on the podcast, was this crazy like 33-day remote Alaskan backcountry hunting expedition. So first of all, have you fully recovered from having written this book and wandered all over the globe doing all this crazy stuff?
I think so. I think I'm about there. My legs, the soreness is starting to dissipate from my legs from all the walking, but yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I want to hear a little bit more about the hunting story for sure. But I also want to get into kind of your background of why you wrote this book in the first place. Cause I think you say in the book that you were basically drinking yourself into oblivion with alcohol before you decided to go on this quest I believe you described it as rewild yourself. So was this like your own personal desire to go out and write a book like this? Or is this one of those random assignments from a magazine that kind of wound up expanding and developing into a book?
Yeah, I think it was more the latter. I think it was magazine assignments and personal history. So, you know, I read in the book that I come from this long line of men who just seem to hum on, you know, booze, bedlam, and bullshit, frankly. The Easter name is well known in the Idaho jail system. And I was sort of walking that same line. Like, I'm the type of person, you know, my life looked pretty good on paper. I was working on staff at Men's Health. I had my name in a lot of big magazines and stuff. But, you know, you give me one drink and I'm going to have more than one, no question. I always like to joke that my favorite drink has always been the next one. You know, that works and is fun until it's not, right? And I reached this point in my life where, you know, things were kind of falling apart. And I realized that if I continued drinking the way I did, I was going to end up dying early. And I didn't know, you know, if I was going to die at 35 or 55 or 75. I just knew it would be earlier than it would be if I were to stop drinking.
Kind of depends on how genetically equipped your liver is. But yeah, it's one of those weird deals. I don't know if you even ran into this writing the book, man. But, you know, alcohol is kind of interesting because there's some evidence that, back to this whole concept of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, that microdosing with alcohol, you know, like drinking small amounts, like they even, you know, show that a lot of these folks in the blue zones do, is good for you, especially it seems when done in a social context. And then once you get past, I think it's about an average of a couple of drinks a day for guys and a drink a day for girls, you get to the point where, you know, all the acetaldehyde and toxin buildup kind of starts to bite you in the butt. But it's really interesting that alcohol is like good for you in very small amounts. And then you run into, of course, all the issues that you ran into.
Yeah. And I think for me, I mean, my liver wasn't going to be the thing that kills me. It would be my brain when I was drinking, because I'd be like, you know what? I could probably drive right now. Let's see how fast this car can go.
Oh, geez.
I mean, that's the kind of behavior leads me into, you know. And then one morning, for whatever reason, I woke up and I could very clearly see that, you know, like I said, this thing was going to end me early, or I could take this other path that was, you know, scary, uncomfortable. I knew it was going to be hard, and I could try and get sober, you know. And so I did that. And I can tell you, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. Very uncomfortable.
Getting sober was?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What'd you do?
For me, I had to like relearn life and how to live it, you know, because alcohol was something that I sort of leaned on for a lot of different situations. It was kind of a comfort blanket.
Did you go to like one of these detox centers where you get locked away and, I don't know, put in a straitjacket or whatever happens with those things? Or were you more of like an AA guy?
I didn't go to a detox center, no. It was more, you know, I had a friend who had gotten sober. I called him, asked for advice, and then, you know, just leaned on people, basically. But from that experience, I could kind of learn. It was one of like the rawest experiences I had, where it showed me that in order to improve your life, you often have to go through discomfort. And this is something that I had thought about, too, working at Men's Health, where everything I wrote about there, whether it be fitness, you know, weight loss, or even improving your mental health, usually comes with having to go through some discomfort, right? If you want to get really fit, you're going to have to work out a lot, and working out is uncomfortable.
Yeah, it can be. It seems like there's this new surge of devices that promise to make workouts a lot more simple or require no blood, sweat, and tears at all. That's like the one thing that kind of annoys me, not to get all negative, in the biohacking sector is we're figuring out shortcuts now, right? Ways to somehow get fit or pop a so-called exercise pill without actually experiencing the burn. And I get some of that stuff. You know, I've even talked about some of these things in my podcast, you know, like sitting in a sauna instead of actually going out and exercising to maintain muscle, or getting on one of these. I just did an interview about this bike called the Carol bike. You know, it's like a 9-minute workout that, you know, supposedly gives you all the benefits of, you know, hammering on a bike for a couple hours. And, you know, the idea of, you know, like consuming a supplement like ATP or oxaloacetate or something like that to shift the body into a biochemical scenario similar to what you might experience from exercising. I don't know a lot of uber fit people, and especially athletes, who use those approaches. Those are more things for people who just like have almost no time at all and just want to dip in and get the minimum effective dose of exercise. But yeah, I mean, you have to at some point experience some of the discomfort of exercise, I think, and that's what holds a lot of people back, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I could see those type of things being useful for some, if it's like, I'm not going to do anything, or I'm going to do
right.
That.
Yeah. That, or they're like they're like the icing on the cake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I had that basically. And then I ended up doing this, I ended up getting commissioned by Men's Health to profile a dude whose name is Donnie Vincent. And he goes into, you know, super remote areas and bow hunts. That like way deep in the backcountry, and he'll spend months out there.
And he's very like self-sustained, right? Like he just goes out on his own, and that's what he's known for. Just like this solo hunter goes deep into these wilderness excursions. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He, you know, for a long time he worked for Fish and Wildlife, and they would send him up middle of nowhere Alaska to do salmon counts on, you know, on a river up there. And he'd be up there for like 6 months living out of a tent, and he'd see someone every 4 weeks when they would bring in food up or whatever. So he's a unique dude. But, you know, from that too, it was like, I'd had this, this notion that like, oh, okay, you got to go through discomfort to improve your life. And then I go out, and we weren't even out there for that long. I was with him for like 5 days. We're up in, some mountains in Nevada that were pretty remote and high up.
Did you know him before that? Or did you like get connected with him through your magazine editor or something like that?
I had seen some of his work, and I just thought what he was doing was pretty intriguing. And so I just reached out to him, and, you know, we sort of became buddies, and I pitched a story on him and got accepted. So then I found myself up in the middle of nowhere, basically. And, it was interesting too, because it, all of a sudden I get introduced to all these discomforts that we just don't face in modern life anymore. Right. It's like, it's freezing cold up there the entire time. We're trying to pack as light as possible. So food is at a premium. I'm starving the entire time. We're sitting on a hill glassing for elk most of the day. I'm bored out of my mind because I don't have my cell phone. Everything we did took effort, you know, to get water. We'd have to hike way down this mountain and then hike it back up.
Had you been hunting before that experience?
Not seriously. No, I mean, I'd been with some guys, but it was more like dudes who wanted to just tip back whiskey in the woods and call it hunting.
Yeah. Right. So, spread corn really on the ground and climb into a tree stand with a gun and wait.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah.
So then from there, Donnie and I become friends, basically, and we keep in touch, and the article comes out. We got a lot of good feedback. He calls me up maybe like a year later and asks, hey, you know, I'm going up to the Arctic for more than a month. Do you want to come with me? And I'm like, and before I can say no, he gets in on this sales pitch and he's like, you know, it's going to be the most epic thing you'll ever do in your life. We're going to fly in and you'll just think, oh my God, the land is so big, and we're going to see grizzly bears. We're going to ford glacial rivers and on and on and on. Right. He's like, Mr. Sales Pitch. And I'm listening to this in my air conditioned home in Las Vegas, you know, sitting on the couch going, yeah, I could do that, you know? So I sign on, and from there, the book just kind of all came together in terms of like, oh, maybe there's a way to really investigate all these forms of discomfort that we've lost over time from our lives that used to keep us relatively healthy, right? So my month in the Arctic, it essentially serves as this overarching narrative for where I get into these different forms of discomfort that I think are still important for humans that we've lost.
Did you actually wind up getting an animal on that hunt with Donnie?
Yeah, caribou. So we were hunting caribou, and I had never killed anything before. So that was an intense experience, but that taught me a ton about the life cycle and like what it takes for the food that we eat to just sort of show up and appear. It definitely changed my relationship with food, that for sure.
How'd it go down? Like after all that hunting, you know, wasn't like 30 days or something like that that you were out there before you got anything?
Yeah, we were up there for more than a month. So I ended up killing on probably week two. And, you know, we'd just been glassing for animals all the time. We could just never get them because the tundra is totally wide open. Like there's nothing out there, right? It's just these undulating old mountains. And so caribou are one of the fastest land animals. I mean, they can truck it at like 50 miles an hour. So they can see you coming because there's nowhere to hide, and they'll just bolt away. So it's a tough hunt. But one day we got in a position where we had been glassing on this hill and these caribou come through because they're migrating at the time. And we figured if we could get to the other side of this knoll, they were eventually going to cross it, and we might be in a good position to just be down on the ground and sort of pick them off from there. So we, you know, get up and we truck over this knoll and we like hit the ground, belly crawl like hundreds of yards across the tundra. And granted, at that time, like before I even got up there, I wasn't even sure if I was going to hunt because I'm a journalist, right? So like journalists don't participate in the story. They're not the story. We cover the story. And I had kind of told Donnie as much, and he told me, you know, look, man, I think you're going to understand why I go out there and why hunting is important if you actually hunt. So I trusted him on that. So, you know, now here I am, rifle in hand, moving across, like army crawling across the tundra. And just as Donnie predicted, it's like these antlers like pop up over this knoll, right? And there's like probably 30 different animals in the herd. We're watching them and they keep coming closer. And I noticed that one of them, has a limp. He's super old. So we're trying to hunt the oldest animal we can, because that usually helps the health of the herd as a whole. Whereas if you, you know, take a younger animal, it'll do the opposite. And we see this one that is limping because he's been injured and he's got to be like 12, 13 years old, which is like the end of their life cycle. So I decided I'm going to do it, right? Eventually they get in they keep moving in and out of the herd. So it's really hard because like one minute you'll have the animal in the scope and then the next there's like another animal in front of them. And it's hard to keep track of them, but eventually like the animal's cleared and there's that one old bull. Yeah. Pulled the trigger. And I'll tell you, like right after that, I was a mess, dude. Like I'd never killed anything. My immediate reaction was like 100% regret. I'm like, what have you done? And Donnie was a good person to go with because he gave me like a few minutes just with the animals. He's like, cause we ditched all our gear, you know, just left it back there. So he went and got all that stuff. And what really changed my mind was that we start breaking the animal down, right? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is meat. It just looks like meat, right?
Kinda. Looks a little bit different if all you've gotten are the flash frozen packed steaks at Costco or whatever. But yeah, it remotely resembles meat. I agree.
And so then, you know, I had to ask, like, look, you eat meat all the time, dude, and you never feel an iota of emotion. And so why is it that all of a sudden you're all bent out of shape about this meat, right? So I think that it made me realize that it sort of inserted me in the life cycle and really made me realize, like, look, for one thing to live on, another thing has to die. And then number two is that I'm not left out of that, right? So it's kind of gives you that understanding as well. One of the more important things in my life.
Wow. Did you wind up packing meat home or eating out there in the field, or what did you do with the meat?
We packed everything back. So we were about 5 miles from camp. And so we break down the animal. We get everything we can use in our packs. And, you know, they're probably weighing at this point like 110-ish pounds, I would say, each. And then we have to hike it back to camp. And it was, of course, all uphill. And the tundra is, I don't know if you've ever been up there, but it is like the gnarliest thing you could ever walk on. It's like half frozen.
I've never done it. Like I've hunted the like Hawaiian lava fields and stuff like that, where your boots get all torn up from the lava rock. And actually had an Alaska 10-day hunt planned for last year and decided to delay it until my sons were old enough to come with me, because I kind of decided if I'm gonna go up and do this, I want to take my sons with me. So it's gonna happen. But no, I've never actually even ever been to Alaska. It's totally on my bucket list to go on a fishing and hunting expedition up there, though.
Oh, you'll love it, man. I mean, it's really wild up there. It's so, it's just so, like, you can be so remote in that state that it's just mind blowing. But the ground in above the Arctic Circle is half frozen, covered in all these things called tundra tussocks, which are these balls of grass that are basically half basketballs. So, you know, if you step on the frozen stuff, all your energy on each step gets sucked out. If you step balls, you could roll an ankle. So it's just like, you know, 1 mile out there is like 10 on a paved road. It's just wild. So that was one of the harder things I've ever had to do, is rucking that insane load home across the crazy ground of the tundra.
Yeah. And so you do this hunt, and this hunt, did you say that was like the kickoff for writing the book, like the first hard thing that you did, or is that kind of like in the midst of all these other hard things that you explored in writing the book?
That really encapsulated all of them for me. So, you know, in the book, it's like I'll talk about something that is happening to me up there, and then I will get into other travels I took around that same topic. So, for example, I have a section on exercise and how we view exercise now, and how carrying weight is this form of exercise that we've kind of lost over time. So as I'm carrying, for example, in the book, as I'm carrying the caribou back to camp, I sort of break out into a section where I travel to Harvard and also Jacksonville. So I traveled to Harvard to talk to anthropologists who study why the human body is built the way it is, and then to Jacksonville to meet with some special forces soldiers who are trying to make rucking popular among average people. So I'm sure all your listeners know what rucking is, but just in case, essentially carrying a weighted backpack, walking with a weighted backpack, and what its benefits are.
There's so many things that you did in the book. And by the way, rucking, I am convinced, is one of the lowest hanging fruits for getting fit for people who just don't want to fuss around with the complexities of going to the gym, or who want kind of something not simple to do, but easy from a decision-making fatigue standpoint, right? Like I have a backpack that's always got anywhere from 60 to 80 pounds in it, just always in the garage, so that if I decide I want to do a workout, like a rucking workout, but I just don't want to mess around, you know, with the gym or with kettlebells or with bikes or anything else like that, I just put on that backpack and walk. And sometimes do the same thing with a weighted vest. I started doing that when I was training for the SEAL fit, which would have been an interesting one for you to do in the book. They do like the Navy SEAL Hell Week for civilians. I did that about 4 years ago. I think they call it Kokoro, and all you're doing the whole freaking time is rucking. Like it's rucking, then you're doing Murph, then you're rucking, then you're in the Pacific Ocean for 6 hours, then you're rucking and then doing a beat down on they call it the grinder outside the CrossFit facility. And so I did a ton of rucking, and it's kind of funny because they supply you with these cheap backpacks as soon as you arrive. You know, if you've been training with like an internal carbon frame that's comfortably set on the shoulders with the perfect waist pad and everything, like they just basically toss that and, you know, put a whole bunch of sand in a backpack and hand this old crappy backpack that seems like it's 10 years old to you. And then that's your very uncomfortable chafing version of a rucksack. But yeah, I think that that rucking is often underemphasized in terms of its efficacy for training, and I think would certainly fall into the category of something that is that can be uncomfortable, especially if your pack isn't set up correctly. There were some other things though aside from rucking that you did in the book that I just found fascinating. So can I rapid fire some stuff at you?
Yeah, dude, send them my
way. Okay, so the ancient Japanese practice to build championship athletes, I think it's called like misogi or something like that, but tell me about that. I haven't really talked about this much before on the podcast, but I think this is a cool one.
Okay, so I meet this guy in my travels. His name is Marcus Elliott. Two things you need to know about this guy. One is that he is a seeker. So he's been going to Burning Man since way back in the day, got himself through college by counting cards, lived out of a VW bus. Number two that you need to know about this guy is that he's brilliant. He got his MD from Harvard and he decides, I don't want to be a doctor. I want to revolutionize sports science. This is in the early 2000s. So his first job that he took was with the Patriots, and they had an injury rate. They had a hamstring injury rate of about 23 injuries per year. And he starts applying all this like movement science to the problem, and he drops it to 3 a year. They start winning Super Bowls. Obviously, Tom Brady was helpful in that. But at the same time, if your entire team has injuries, that's not going to help either, right? So he kind of does this. He bounces around to different leagues. But ultimately, now he owns this facility called P3. And they do a lot of tracking of people's movement. So they'll put these monitors on pro athletes. And everyone in the NBA goes through P3. And have them go through all the motions they would do in a game, right? And so then they'll analyze all the data, and it goes through this, you know, big cloud AI thing, and it compares it to other players and past injuries. And so they can see basically and try to predict like, okay, well, we see that your knee is caving in this much when you do this jump. Based on all the other players we've analyzed, you have a 60% chance of tearing an ACL this season or whatever it might be, right? So he's into like numbers, data, figure, all that stuff. But he also realizes it improves not only professional athletes, but also everyday people. It can't always be measured, right? So there's like certain guys in sports or women who they're just like aces at the end of a game. It's like when the clock is low and you're tied, there are certain people you give the ball to because they just have something on board psychologically, right? So to get to those sort of deeper psychological elements, he does this thing called misogi, and it's based on this ancient
M-I-S-O-G-I, right?
Yep, M-I-S-O-G-I. And it is based on this ancient Japanese myth that is effectively a hero's journey, which you see, you know, Joseph Campbell did a lot of work around those. Basically, throughout time and space, you see all these different cultures have hero's journeys of different forms in the form of myths. And the arc is all the same though. It's basically the hero leaves the comfort of home. They go into this trying middle ground where they really struggle. They really suffer. They're not sure if they're going to make it out, but they do make it out and they return home and they're a better person for it. They have like more courage. They're more capable. They're more confident, et cetera. So to get to that, back to this misogi idea is, once a year, Marcus Elliott and just a handful of guys that he'll do it with, whoever, will do something really, really hard in nature. And there's only two rules to misogi. One is that it has to be really hard. And they define that by saying you should have a true 50-50 shot of finishing it. And then number two is that you can't die, which is basically a tongue-in-cheek way of saying, don't be dumb with this, right? Be smart about it. But the idea is that when you choose something that where you actually think that you could fail, right, you're going to get to a point in the process of whatever you choose, whether it be some really far run, you've never run that far of distance, or some totally new thing you're going to throw yourself into. Like one year they hadn't really stand up paddleboard and they decided they're going to stand up paddleboard across the Santa Barbara Channel. But you're going to reach a point where you think you've hit your edge, right? You're like, I'm at my edge. I got to quit. I can't do this anymore. And if you're able to go past that edge by putting one foot in front of the other, making the next stroke on that paddleboard, you can then look back and say, wait a minute, I thought my edge was back there, but I'm clearly past it. So I've sold myself short here, right? Which leads to the bigger question of, well, where else in my life am I selling myself short? You know, so mm-hmm. It can lead to realizations like that. And then number two, I think he talks about it has a lot of benefits of helping people get rid of fear. Because failure today is often, you know, you misspeak in front of your boss or you mess up a number on a spreadsheet, whatever. It's not the same failures that we used to face in our past, where failure could often mean death. But we still fear these sort of modern failures like they are death, right? And if you can engage in an environment with a high rate of failure, that can often show people that their fears, their modern fears, are more unfounded.
So what are some examples of some misogies that Marcus Elliott weaves into his training protocols?
So one year, it was him, Kyle Korver, who's an NBA guy. I think he might have retired. I'm not sure, recently. And a couple other guys who were just kind of average people. One year they decide they're going to get this 85-pound boulder and they're going to walk it, I think, 5 miles underneath the Santa Barbara Channel. So one guy would dive down, pick up the boulder, walk 10 yards or whatever it might be, drop it. The next guy would go down and rinse and repeat effectively for hours and hours until the boulder's at point B. I mean, they've also done simple things like pick the farthest peak we can see and let's see if we can get there in a day, that kind of thing. And what he's really trying to do is mimic the challenges that we used to often faced in the past as humans, right? So in the past, it's like we used to have to do, I mean, frankly, epic shit all the time, right? This could be we had some big hunt we were going on. This could be that we had to get from, you know, move our family over a pass or whatever it might be. And the consequences, if we failed, could be pretty bad, right? But each time we would complete one of these challenges that the world would just naturally throw at us in the past, we would learn what our potential was. And today we often don't face these moments of having a high rate of failure, being outside of nature and really having to struggle that used to teach us so much about ourselves. So he's really effectively just trying to mimic those things that we used to face in the past.
Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor. All right, folks. Clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits, and inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben.
Did you actually do the one where you carry the rock underwater?
I did not do that with him. No, that was a while. I think that was maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, I actually did a training session like that. I forget who I was with in Malibu. This guy invited me out to run up the dunes kind of outside of Malibu, these sand dunes outside of Malibu. And we did all our dune sprint workouts. And then he brought us down to the water. And literally, we just took these big rocks out into the water. You carry the rock until you get to the point where you're deep enough to where you're under the water. And then you just walk it for as long as you can. And then kind of like set the rock down on the bottom of the sand at the bottom of the ocean and come up, take a breath, and then dive back down, grab the rock and keep walking. And we were just doing like 50-yard repeats and then turning around and going the other way. But I mean, in terms of the slight panic from knowing that you're a little bit hypoxic and carrying something under the water to the strain of carrying something under the water, it was pretty difficult. It reminded me a lot of another workout that's pretty popular in Malibu, you know, the Laird Hamilton pool workout where you go up to Laird's and you're doing everything from like hops with the dumbbell from the bottom of the pool to the top and coming up for a breath to putting a dumbbell between your legs and doing like almost like a treading water motion. They call it a seahorse from one side of the pool to the other to, you know, getting out of the pool and dropping into the sauna and then into the ice bath and getting back into the pool. But it kind of has a similar flavor as that underwater rock carrying that's part of the misogi. And I recommend anyone who decides to do that, bring a partner, proceed at your own risk, but it's actually a pretty cool way to train because you're getting the breath work, you're getting the cold, you're getting the resistance training, and it actually doesn't beat up the body too much because there's not a lot of muscle fiber tearing that occurs just because you're in a lower gravity situation and under the water. But it's hopefully going to give people a little bit more, readily available way to train than buying a plane ticket up to Alaska to hunt caribou. And so the misogi is interesting. That's, and by the way, I'll hunt down links to more information on a lot of this stuff and to your book. If folks go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/comfortcrisis, which is also the name of the book, of course. So you got this 33-day hunting expedition. You did the misogi stuff with Marcus Elliott. There was another guy that you talked about in the book who I found super interesting. I hadn't heard of him before, but you seem to be a little bit not obsessed with this guy, but very, very interested in him and kind of fill in a lot of details about him in the book. His name, I think, was Trevor Cashy or something like that.
Cashy, yep.
Yeah, tell me about him.
Yeah, so this kid is, so first of all, I think he was in his late 20s. And look, working at Men's Health and writing for Scientific American and all these different publications, I talk to smart people a lot, right? Like I've talked to people who've won the Nobel Prize, that kind of thing. And I've never talked to a dude who thinks like this guy. He just has an amazing ability to break down assumptions and get to the heart of things. So his background is that I think he got his PhD at about 23 years old, which is about 7 years earlier than you should. But he's interesting too, because he came from a little bit of a broken home as well. So, you know, at one point he was like dealing with the Hell's Angels and doing all this different crazy stuff with them, sort of being like a real life Walter White type character, and then, you know, cleaned up his act. But today he owns a company called Trevor Cashy Nutrition, and they help people. Most of their clients are weight loss clients. They do have some performance clients. He's helped quite a few Olympic teams, also some champion powerlifters and ultra runners and all these different folks. But I'd say their average client is a weight loss client. And it's obviously it's mostly a person who's tried a lot of different things and it hasn't worked. A lot of what he does is just based in psychology, because his argument is effectively that he doesn't really care what you eat. He cares why you eat, right? So like most people know how to eat generally healthy. The question is, why aren't you eating generally healthy, right? So a lot of it is him helping people unpeel their layers, also becoming aware of what they actually eat, because most people tend to have no idea like how much they eat in a day. You know, you look at the research around that, and especially people who tend to be overweight, they tend to have just like a massive gap between the actual amount of calories that they eat and what they thought they, yeah, he's just a really fascinating dude who's able to put basic nutrition information and present it in a really sort of elegant, compelling way. And I just love talking to him about anything, really. I mean, he's got interesting takes on everything.
So when you say interesting takes, like what are some examples of some stuff you learned from him that kind of either blew your mind or was new information?
You know, I think for the average person, it's like, we think that processed food is bad, right? And, you know, he talked about really opening up the question. Is he asked a lot of like, well, why do we do this thing in the first place? And with something like processed food, it's because it makes it safer, it makes it easier to transport, and it makes it last longer, right? So if we don't process food, all of a sudden we have a problem. We're all working on a farm, right? Because we have to come up with our own food because it's not going to last long. So basically de-villainizing, I think, a lot of the arguments that you see in nutrition today. It's like most diets are set up in such a way where one food or component of food is the villain. And then on the other side is like the good guy, right? So low carb is that, you know, carbs are the villain. Low fat is that fat is the villain, and on and on and on, right? Mediterranean diet, foods that aren't from the Mediterranean are the villain. Where really, when you look at it, most diets work if people follow them. So what he's doing is trying to help getting people to actually follow them.
So with this guy, Trevor, did you actually wind up changing your diet at all? Or have you kind of, since writing the book, figured out a diet protocol that kind of fits into this whole category of like the combination of hormesis and discomfort and some of the stuff you learned from Trevor?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the one commonality you see with most diets is that, especially if a person needs to lose weight, there's going to be some discomfort in the form of hunger, right? Because you're going to have to drop the number of calories you're eating, and that's going to lead to hunger. And if you can't deal with that, well, then you have a problem. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why most average diets tend to fail people, is that, you know, it works for 5 weeks, great. And then your body responds by upping its hunger signals. And then all of a sudden it's like, I can't really deal with this. And then you're off the wagon. So for me, you know, I was working at Men's Health. I had access to a lot of smart nutrition minds and had, you know, worked with a few of them. But he really just first had me figure out exactly what my habits were. And this was just, dude, weigh your food for like 2 weeks. And that was a freaking eye opener for me, because I'm eating foods that I think the average person would consider healthy, right? I'm eating like sweet potatoes, peanut butter, apples, protein shakes. And it's like, for example, the first time I ever weigh what a serving of peanut butter actually is, holy hell, that is
not very much.
No, it's like nothing. I mean, so I thought I was eating a lunch that was like 500 calories, right? Because it was like an apple, some peanut butter, and a protein shake. It was just like something I could do at my desk really easy. This was not when I was at Men's Health. And the serving of peanut butter I had was like 600 calories. So it's like, oh, that's like more calories than I would eat if I would have just gone down to Wendy's. So that, you know, once I became aware of my own behaviors around nutrition, and had some actual data behind them, then it was easy to tweak that data. And it's like, I lost a lot of weight, and I wasn't even in the overweight category or anything, but I was like, maybe I'm 6'1" and I was maybe 189. You know, pretty muscly, but there was like a layer there. And once I started working with him, I mean, I was like down to 175 and just like absolutely shredded to the gills and still eating like foods I wanted to eat. I just had to work them in more intelligently.
Interesting. So Trevor Casey, what'd you say his website is again? I might have to go check out more of what this guy does.
Yeah, check him out. It's TrevorCasheyNutrition.com. TKN, I think, is what, and they're on Instagram, they're on Facebook and all these different places. He worked with the 2016, I can't remember, it was one of the Eastern Bloc countries for a while with their combat sports team, and they ended up winning a ton of medals. So he definitely does work in the performance space as well. Fascinating cat.
All right, cool. I'll look him up. And so in addition to some of the things that we've talked about already, were there any particularly intriguing or difficult adventures that you went on for the book that you think just rocked your world as far as the discomfort component or as far as it just being super unique or educational for you?
In terms of unique and educational, so I traveled to Bhutan, right? So after I killed this caribou.
Bhutan?
Yep, Bhutan.
Okay.
And after I killed the caribou, I start thinking about death a lot more, because it's like this, it just slaps you in the face that like, hey man, you know, one day you're going to die too. And Bhutan is interesting because they view death a lot differently than we do in the United States. So in the United States, death is something we don't want to think about because it's an uncomfortable thought, right? And this extends, you see this in our funeral system where when someone dies, it's like, we make them look as alive as possible so we can look at them for, you know, an hour, and then we send them in the ground and we're told, you know, take your mind off it. Don't think about
right.
it. Stay busy.
Comma, also in the mass economic shutdown based on the philosophy that no one ever should be able to die from a virus. Nobody should be allowed to contribute to the buildup of herd immunity. Therefore, we do everything we can at all costs to hold death back without really giving much of a thought to considering honorable deaths and basically the way that humankind has functioned for a long time, you know, allowing some sickness to go through the population, except the fact that some people are going to perish, particularly the older or the immunocompromised. I realize this might sound heartless, but it's also just kind of the way the world has worked for a very long time. And, you know, instead we simply hide away death or fear death or run away from death and have to deal with all the consequences as a result. But yeah, there is this weird, like, just fear of death, like clinging to life, you know, and you see that kind of arising at the same time as this transhumanistic emergence of just trying to live as long as possible. I realize that might sound a little bit hypocritical coming from a guy in the biohacking sector where a great, great deal of what we talk about is anti-aging and longevity. But you're right. Death is no longer something considered honorable or like the passage into another life or anything like that. It's just basically hold it back at all costs. Nobody should die ever. And it's I don't think that's really a healthy way to think about death.
I agree. And I mean, to your point, some crazy, I think it's like 20-30% of healthcare spending is on people who, I think their last week or two of life. And it's clearly stuff that is not going to make them any better. We're just trying to keep them alive for a little bit longer.
Right.
They're
right.
Ultimately dying.
Lifespan without health span.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is different than Bhutan. Okay. So I traveled there, and Bhutan is interesting because they're very underdeveloped. You know, their development ranking is like it's well into the hundreds. I think it's over 150. There's not a single stoplight in the country. They're surely not like Starbucks and fast food and all that kind of stuff. But interestingly enough, they consistently rank among the happiest countries in the world. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But one of them, researchers think, is how they view and relate to death. So in Bhutan, death is part of life, effectively. So they have these when someone dies, their ashes are put in these little clay pyramids called sasas, and they are placed all over the country. These things are like everywhere. Every road bend, you'll see like 100 of them. Every windowsill in the city has them. They're everywhere. And people are told to think about their death anywhere from 1 to 3 times every single day. And I mean, a lot of like art and plays and cultural stuff centers around death. So I went there to learn about this. So I met with a guy who studies death there. He's an economist who was trained in Oxford, and he runs the Gross National Happiness Center, which is effectively sort of like our State Department or Department of the Interior. It's like a department that studies happiness. Another person I met with, and this was really fascinating, is a monk who's super high up in the Buddhist faith. He's a Kenpo. And to get up to meet this dude, you have to have a driver in Bhutan. It's part of the law if you're a tourist. And my driver's got this like smart car, basically. And we have to drive up to this monastery that's on this like cliff road that's all rutted out 4x4. And this dude, like, man, he pushed that smart car to the brink. And I was going to have to buy this dude a new car by the time this trip was over. But we make it. And so then I hike into this monastery, and this Kenpo lives in this little shack, kind of in the shadow of it. I get in there, the first room, there's nothing in this room. Go through the next door, and there's like this really basic kitchen with like, I don't even know if there's running water, to be honest. And then finally I pull back this drape for the third room, and this dude is sitting there, and you know, the room's filled with incense smoke. There's like this statue of the Buddha, and this light is like filtering in through the room and catching the smoke and illuminating this dude's face. And he's sitting in the lotus position, and he just looks over at me and just goes, "Welcome," you know. And it was just like, holy hell, this is like the most cliche thing ever, right? Like, this gangly Western writer has come to see the guru. But I end up talking to this guy for a few hours, and he told me to think about it like this. He goes, I want you to pretend that you are walking along the trail, and at the end of the trail is a cliff. And then he goes, well, the catch is that the cliff is death, and you are walking that trail right now. And he goes, don't you want to know that there is a cliff at the end of this trail? Because if you know that, it might change how you walk the trail, right? You might take in the wilderness a little more. You might have different conversations with the people that you walk that trail with. But in the United States, we don't want to know about the cliff. And so what happens by ignoring death and not taking death into your mind is that you lose out on something that can positively change your behavior. So when you think about death, usually it has a way of aligning your priorities and making sort of the trivial things that we can get caught up in life sort of fall away. And that ultimately is what can lead to happiness, by having positive behavior shifts. And what's interesting is they've actually done studies on this in the United States, where they've had one group think of, you know, something random, and then another group think of their own death, and then they'll track them over time. And the people who think about their death report being happier, because it helps helps them make better decisions in their life about how they want to spend the limited time that they have.
Interesting. And Bhutan is ranked as like one of the happiest countries in the world, right?
Yeah, consistently.
So after going through that, do you have any, I guess, more practical takeaways for people as far as like how to either experience death before death or think about death in a way that would allow them to actually attain that type of happiness?
Yeah, I think that it's just figuring out, you know, the people I talk to there, all of them basically said, think about it in some capacity every day. The guy, the happiness researcher, he told me, think about it every night before you go to bed. Just take 5 minutes. And I mean, I can tell you, having done this, like some nights it's the most uncomfortable thing you could ever think about. Like, it is freaking terrifying, right? But I found that because after going through that discomfort of realizing that, like, what does it mean to not exist anymore? Like, that's a deep question. You peel that on that onion enough, it's pretty wild. But because of that, it's helped me align how I spend my time and like how I'm going to treat people. Like, even the fact of of doing it, I think. Like, if I'm in traffic and someone cuts me off, I'm just like not as agitated anymore. I'm just like, eh, whatever. I'm going to die. I'm not going to spend my time getting worked up over just like some random person. Like, eh, you know, maybe they're on their way to the hospital or something.
Yeah, it's interesting because you'll find that a lot of people dramatically change the way they live after having a near-death experience or even going through like a plant medicine-based, you know, ego death or I forget what they call it, basically something that simulates the death experience. It seems to change people pretty dramatically, like that constant awareness of one's own mortality. I think that even though it might seem like a little bit of a far cry from death specifically, I personally find a great deal of value in my evening practice of self-examination, since how we live our days is how we live our lives. And I, along with my family, at the end of each day, replay the entire day like a movie in my mind, asking, you know, what good have I done? What could I have done better? How did I, or where was I most connected to my life's purpose? And to a certain extent, I actually feel like I get from that a lot of the similar sensations I get when I think about my death, my deathbed, what I want to be known for, what I want people to say about me, you know, how I want people to feel at my funeral, etc. And, you know, it'd be interesting, honestly, to think about how you could weave into something like a self-examination process, you know, some type of forward thinking to one's deathbed. Like, what would I think about this day that I have lived today if I were on my deathbed? If I were on my deathbed, what would the regrets be? What would I be proud of? What would I have done differently if I knew I was going to be dead tomorrow? You know, it might sound like kind of a depressive way of finishing one's day. Or you know, polishing off one's evening with that type of practice, but you know, it does seem to make sense. I'm even thinking as you're talking to me about potentially, you know, weaving that into my process this week, just to see how it changes the way that I frame each day. You know,
yeah, and I mean, I think this hit me hard when I learned. I was just, it's so random how just things come into your life, but I was listening to some random podcast and they started talking about the cosmic calendar. So this puts like all of the universe's time on a year long scale. And so, you know, for example, like Big Bang happens on January 1st, right? Planets start forming, and I'm making the months up at this point, but it's like in March or whatever, the Earth forms in say August. Well, I told you all that to basically tell you that all of human history would be December 31st at like 11, would start at December 31st at like 11:59:41. All of human history that we have recorded. I mean, that's how insignificant our time on Earth is in the grand scheme of the time in the universe, which is just like, holy hell. Like, that can kind of make you, for me, I think it has given me humility, which, you know, a lot of people think, you know, being humble is like, oh yeah, not a big deal. Like, I'm not taking credit for these things I did. No, being humble is realizing that like, you're not that damn important in the grand scheme of time and space. And for me, that also changes my behavior in such a way that I just don't take myself so damn seriously anymore. And that makes me like an easier person to be around. It also, oddly enough, you would think that that would hurt someone's work. No, it actually improves my work because I can write it with a more laid back approach. I can be more playful with things, and I think that tends to resonate more with people.
Now, you also, in addition to happiness, you talk about boredom in the book. Why do you talk about boredom in you know, a book about hormesis and discomfort?
Yeah, so I started thinking about this when we were hunting, because we're sitting on these hills for like hours and hours and hours waiting for caribou to come through, and it's not happening, right? I didn't have any cell phone service up there, not for, you know, 100 miles. Didn't bring a book, didn't bring a magazine, didn't bring an iPad, all that kind of stuff. So all of a sudden I found myself bored again, right? And to deal with the boredom, we did all kinds of weird stuff. We started reading all the labels on our energy bars. We started reading the tags on our jackets. I did more push-ups than I've done in a year. I came up with like 17 different story ideas.
Think about bringing a Kindle just like preloaded with a bunch of books just in case?
Nope.
Bring that's what I would have done.
That would have been some productive time. But so I told you that to tell you this, is that boredom is essentially this evolutionary discomfort that humans evolved the capacity for, because it would tell us whenever we are doing something where our time, return on our time invested had worn thin, boredom kicks on and basically tells you, do something else. right? It throws discomfort at you that makes you want to do something else. Now, in our past, this was a good thing, because if let's say you and I are hunting and we actually need food or we're going to starve, if we're not having the success, boredom kicks on and we're like, all right, let's like go pick some berries or something. We got to do something here, right? So boredom can be a good thing. It can push us into different ways to use our time that are productive. But mm-hmm. I read in the book that now whenever we feel a tinge of boredom, it's like, what do? We immediately pull out our cell phone. We have a million different screens. So you look at the average person now spends more than 12 hours a day engaging with digital media. That's from cell phones, that's from TVs, that's from computers, that's from radio, and on and on and on. So we didn't have any of this shit in our life, like even 100 years ago, right? Now it's effectively become our life. So we have these really easy, effortless escapes from the discomfort of boredom. And I would argue they're not always pushing our life forward. I'm not saying that everything that happens on your cell phone is bad, not at all. But I am saying it's this really easy, effortless crutch that often doesn't improve your life. And what you find is that when people start to re-engage with boredom, it can improve your creativity. So there's some really interesting studies where they'll take one group and they'll let them do whatever the hell they want, which usually tends to be, you know, read a magazine or go on your cell phone usually. And then they'll take another group and they will bore the heck out of the second group. And they find that the second group consistently comes up with more and more creative answers than the non-bored group. And that's because boredom gives like your brain a little bit of a rest. You start to think of weird things. And so I'm not saying that boredom is always going to lead you into productivity. It could lead you into some like bizarre thought that you're like, well, I don't know where the hell that came from. But it can often lead to good ideas. This is why a lot of people say, yeah, I have my best ideas in the shower. It's because you're bored. You're just sitting there and your mind's kind of going to these weird places, right? It's not engaged. And so in the book, I basically make the argument that you see all this messaging now that's like, we need to use our cell phones less. Use your cell phone less. Here's 57 different ways to use your cell phone less. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes, that is important. Okay. But the problem becomes is like, if you take an hour off your cell phone screen time, great. But then people will go, oh, well, what the hell do I do with my time? And they'll watch Netflix or they'll go on the computer. And your brain doesn't know the difference between those things, right? So I make the argument that we need to think more boredom.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence too on the benefits of daydreaming, the benefits of having time carved out during the day where you're simply allowing the brain to free flow. There's even companies, I think like, you know, Google, for example, that weave into the employee's workday some time for not necessarily boredom, but no actual assigned work to be able to work on free creative projects, which is kind of sort of a form of daydreaming. You know, for my sons, we always keep Monday morning between the time that they wake up all the way up until noon, totally free of any activities. And that's their chance to do art, to walk around outside with their hands in their pockets, you know, whatever they would choose to do. And, you know, mom and I set a good example. When there's downtime at our house, we aren't on our cell phones or watching television. Usually we're engaged in something creative, you know, whether that's, you know, mom, a lot of times it's art or cooking. Me, sometimes it's music or cooking or reading fiction, or sometimes writing, but writing not for work, but for fiction, something more creative. And yeah, I think that you almost have to purposefully or intentionally weave times into the day or plan ahead to have a time where you're just not doing anything, and then set the expectation for yourself that not doing anything preferably means not doing anything in the absence of technology, because I think that's the thing that kind of holds one back from being able to daydream or be bored in an effective or, you know, paradoxically a productive way. So yeah, it is interesting that the values of boredom and how hard it is to be bored these days, truly bored, just because we always have at our beck and call a million websites and podcasts and audiobooks and blogs to be able to listen to. But it is nice sometimes just go for a walk with your hands in your pocket. It's just looking out into the trees or staring at the sky. And, you know, I think we've lost connection to that to a certain extent. So I'm glad that you wrote about it in the book. Are there ways that you've changed your life, like since writing the book, like intentional hard things? I'm just curious, like how you're living your life now. If you're a sauna guy, if you're doing cold baths, if you're, we've established you're not carrying rocks, you know, back and forth under the ocean. But how has your own life changed since writing this book, Michael?
It's definitely changed a lot. I mean, I think for one thing, I'm a lot more grateful for how amazing the modern world is. Like I tell the story of like, I hate flying. And the reason I hate flying is because the seats are cramped and it's always too hot. And like the movies they show you, they all suck. And the food sucks. The coffee sucks. The bathrooms are kind of like, flying is freaking awful, right? Then I go spend like a month in the Arctic, right? I have to take this terrible flight to get up to the Arctic. But once I spend a month out there, you know, I'm freezing cold the entire time. Coffee tough. I'm bored the entire time. If I want to get from point A to point B, I got to carry my heavy backpack somewhere. There's grizzlies out there. If I want to go to the bathroom, I got to like walk off into the tundra and squat and take the rifle because of said grizzlies. On and on and on. Like, it's just uncomfortable in every way. And so when I get on that flight to go from Alaska back to Las Vegas, where I live, like, what do you think my experience of that flight was? It was freaking amazing. Right? It's like, I hadn't sat in a chair for more than a month. I'd been starved out of my mind the entire month. I ate like an unbelievable amount of pretzels, right? Those movies that they show that I used to think were terrible, they were the most entertaining thing I'd ever seen in my life because I'd been reading Clif Bar labels for a month, right? And so that's kind of a long way to explain that I think that all these amazing comforts that we have in our life, they are amazing. They're incredible. But we can easily take them for granted, like how good the world is right now. We can take it for granted. We don't appreciate it. And so for me, it's like when I get back into civilization, now all of a sudden it's like when hot running water comes out of the faucet, now I can occasionally think back to Alaska and be like, man, this thing that's happening right now is unbelievably amazing. And that makes me more grateful. And we know that, I mean, being grateful is, I think, one of the most important things that a human can aim for. I mean, it's associated with all these amazing health outcomes. Don't get me wrong, but more importantly, it just colors your everyday life in such a way that your life is more enjoyable, I think. But beyond that, into some more specifics, so that, you know, you just talked about walking outside. Like, I do that a ton, specifically to get bored and to be outside. So at least 20 minutes every day, I'll take a walk outside without my cell phone, without any headphones, without anything, because it gets me bored and it also puts me out into nature. And so in the book, I also write about all the benefits of nature. I also am rucking a lot more, for sure. I mean, I think back to what we were talking about. I think it is, honestly, it's like, that's the thing that most people should be doing. It's sort of like lifting for people who hate the gym and cardio for people who hate to run. And it is unbelievably easy on your body so long as you don't go too heavy. Like, the injury rate is super low. If you can walk, you can ruck. If you walk your dog, just throw a little bit of weight in a pack and do it. Like, it's so approachable and super low impact, just amazing. So I try and do that quite a bit. What else am I doing? I'm thinking about death, nice and morbid over here every month, every night, but I'm definitely better for it. Even things as simple as, like, you know, I look in the book about, and I'm sure I know you've talked at length about this on your podcast and know far more about it than I do, but even just like the benefits of being cold. It's like, we live at 72 degrees. So in the winter, it's like, we never kick on the furnace because I'm in Las Vegas. So the house will be like 60 degrees. And, you know, I talked to researchers who said, you know, like 60 to 64 is kind of a sweet spot where you're not suffering, but you're getting some of the health benefits of the cold. In the summer, I mean, my gym is in my garage and that place will get up to like 115 in the summer. I still train in there. It's kind of like training in a sauna, you know, not taking the easy way out and going to the air conditioned gym. And just, I mean, on and on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, and one thing that came to mind as you're describing rucking is so many people, I think just need to start walking first. I mean, that's something that, you know, a lot of people think they move. Then you look at their step counts, like 5,000 a day. I think at least just starting with a goal for yourself of 10,000 steps a day is a good way to start, and then start adding the weight after that. But my rule for myself is I simply go through each day, and, you know, that process of self-examination that I described helps out quite a bit with this, asking myself if, not necessarily via a formal exercise session per se, but has my body experienced some amount of discomfort, both physically and mentally, on any given day, right? So what I mean by that is I try not to let a day go by that I haven't either, you know, put an appreciable amount of lactic acid in the muscle, gotten hypoxic, gotten very hot, or gotten very cold, or loaded my muscles with something heavy. And in the same way, I also try not to let a day go by that I haven't learned something new that slightly confuses my brain, or done something that kind of makes smoke come out your ears. Like, I'm trying to teach myself how to play piano right now, right? And it's very odd because I'll do that right now before my dinner with the family. I pop up, you know, after I finished work, and typically our family eats around 7:30 p.m. or so. So around 6:40, 6:45, I sit down to the piano for 15 or 20 minutes and dink around on that. And it's interesting because our family always plays games at night around the dinner table, and I find I'm more sharp, and my mental edge seems to be increased by stimulating some of that neuroplasticity and neurogenesis that comes from just attempting to learn a new musical instrument. Other examples would be I'll read a book that's outside the scope of health or fitness or nutrition or something I can easily understand. Like, for me right now, I'm reading a lot of kind of dense theology books because it's pushing me outside my comfort zone as far as a new topic that I'm learning. Sometimes it's simply having a conversation with a guy like you, you know, and learning something new and needing to wrap my head around new concepts on a podcast. But I think, you know, really a good metric for people to start with, aside from just walking more, is identify one uncomfortable physical activity that you've engaged in during the day. And again, don't overtrain. It doesn't have to be exercise. It can be heat, it can be cold, it can be hypoxia, what have you. And then also identify one thing that you've done that's mentally difficult. And, you know, if I could throw a third in there, I also make sure that I kind of train my spirit each day, right? Like, every single day I'm either doing a devotional or doing a meditation session, or sometimes fasting, sometimes engaging in more deeper sessions of prayer. But I think that this idea of, you know, embracing the stoicism and the rigors of discomfort is something that I think people hear about and give a head nod to. But I really think the trick, Michael, is systematically weaving it into one's life, because what gets measured, what is, you know, gets managed. And really, I think that's the best thing that people could do. And like, the biggest takeaway I'd give people, besides encouraging them to go read your book from this chat with you, is just make sure that you're actually intentionally and mindfully pushing yourself outside your comfort zone when we live in an era where comfort can be so difficult to attain. I do have one last thing that I wanted to run by you. You know, sometimes we talk about the good old days, right? Like our caveman ancestors, and the idea that ancient man did a lot of hard things and therefore was a stronger, fitter, potentially even happier person. Yet I tend to think that, you know, if you took the average caveman, or heck, you know, somebody living in medieval times or whatever, and dropped them into the context of our current scenario, they'd be living like kings of old. They'd be living like the wealthiest person on the planet, with ample access to libraries of information on their smartphone, a host of nutrient dense and calorie dense foods, you know, cars, air conditioning, heating, and they'd really like step back and scratch their heads about all of us running around, like visiting a gym and sweating, or fasting intentionally, or you know, jumping into a cold bath when we don't really have to, because why would you burn those calories when you need them to survive, bro? And so it is kind of interesting for me, because I think sometimes we hearken back to the good old days, especially people in, like, you know, the paleo sector or the ancestor living sector, without necessarily acknowledging the fact that, I mean, to a certain extent, we're quite lucky, and it's not about necessarily forsaking or denying the benefit of all of our modern elements of comfort, but just making sure that we don't let ourselves get too soft. Does that kind of make sense?
Yes. Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, I think that if I had written this book back then, it would be called The Comfort Solution. And I'd be like, yo, we need to invent Twix bars. We need to invent M&Ms. We need to invent all this, as much comfort food as we can. We need climate control. You know what I mean? You get the point that I'm making, that I think what has happened is that the balance has tipped too far. We've tipped too far into comfort. It's like, we know that these things that are uncomfortable, the reason we developed the capacity for discomfort in the first place is because it gave us a survival advantage. So for all of time, it didn't make sense to move more than you needed to, because you were born burning calories, and calories were at a premium. So this is why exercise still sucks today, right? It's why we have a propensity for laziness. It's why we want to avoid the elements at any and all costs, like too hot and too cold. It's why we don't like boredom, right? Because if you didn't get bored in the past, you were probably going to die. But the balance is now tipped too far, where we can just lean into this drive that we have to be comfortable all the time. And we're now living in a comfortable environment. So it's a basic mismatch. Right. Yeah. And so I think really, I'm not suggesting that people, yep. you know, go live in a yurt in the woods and never use tech again. Like, hell no. But I do think that we need to figure out I think we need to analyze, are we overusing or over leaning into some of this stuff? And in the book, I argue yes. I mean, if you look at the US, the 12 hours that we spend in digital media, the fact that more than 70% of the country is overweight or obese, the fact that chronic diseases are just like at an all-time high, mental health problems are at an all-time high, I think we are, you know, and I think that it is choosing the harder thing that can alleviate a lot of those problems, right? Someone who is okay with hunger every now and then and works out is probably not going to be overweight or obese. Someone who is willing to go through discomfort and understands that there is something good for them at the other end is probably not going to have as many mental health problems, and on and on and on. And so I think it's really just finding the balance and appreciating, and back to that story I told you about on the plane, it's like appreciating that we live in an unbelievably amazing world right now. Like, it is an amazing time to be alive. But if we always do the next easy thing in this easy world, like, that's going to get us in trouble too.
The name of the book is The Comfort Crisis: Embrace Discomfort to Reclaim Your Wild, Healthy, and Happy Self. Michael wrote it, of course, and I'll link to that book and also any of the other stuff that Michael and I talk about that I can hunt down, like Trevor Casey's website or more information on these Misogis and so on and so forth. If you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/comfortcrisis, where you can also leave your questions for Michael and I if you have your own feedback or interesting information to add in, because it's always fun to keep the discussion going over there. Michael, thanks so much for coming on the show, man, and for writing the book.
Yeah, Ben, that was awesome. I really enjoyed chatting.
All right, folks. Well, I'm Ben Greenfield, along with Michael Easter, signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have an amazing week. In compliance with the FTC guidelines, please assume the following about links and posts on this site. Most of the links going to products are often affiliate links, of which I receive a small commission from sales of certain items, but the price is the same for you, and sometimes I even get to share a unique and somewhat significant discount with you. In some cases, I might also be an investor in a company I mention. I'm the founder, for example, of Keon LLC, the makers of Keon-branded supplements and products, which I talk about quite a bit. Regardless of the relationship, if I post or talk about an affiliate link to a product, it is indeed something I personally use, support, and with full authenticity and transparency, recommend in good conscience. I personally vet each and every product that I talk about. My first priority is providing valuable information and resources to you that help you positively optimize your mind, body, and spirit. And I'll only ever link to products or resources, affiliate or otherwise, that fit within this purpose. So there's your fancy legal disclaimer.